Chicago Sports Conversation is now.
Martin on the warning track. Let the celebration begin. The Chicago Cubs are NL Central champions.
I feel like we're pretty close. I think that our best baseball is going to come in the postseason.
The Beat.
Second and 15. Terrible pass is picked off by Clinton Dix. And he's dragged down at the 40. That was nowhere near a fair receiver.
On 720 WGN.
It's 4:10 on the Beat, 720 WGN. Sam Panionovic, Kevin Powell, and yes, the Bears still suck.
That is fact.
1-3 now. Mike Glennon, the game manager. He only happens to lead the league in turnovers.
I'm done with people calling Mike Glennon a game manager. Game managers don't turn the ball over.
Four turnovers on Thursday Night Football.
How many total so far?
I think eight.
Okay.
In four games.
We're going to get into this in
there are so many things to talk about. Yes. Actually, the last thing I saw before I left my house, I left about 2:30, and I felt like Tariq Cohen on I-57 and Lakeshore Drive because there were bigger bodies than me everywhere. Trucks, buses. It took almost 90 minutes for me to get in from the south side today, which is a joke. But the last thing I saw as I left my house, Kev, I cried on the inside. Chris Sale was celebrating in the Red Sox clubhouse with champagne all over his body.
Is it tough for you to see Sale dominate and win?
Yes. So we've seen Chris Sale and Jose Quintana
douse
in champagne.
See, I wrote a blog about this, WGNradio.com. Shameless plug there. A couple months ago. Actually, I think it was when Sale was here in town pitching against the White Sox in that, you know, how disappointing it is for White Sox fans to know that you had Chris Sale and Jose Quintana at the top of your rotation. And not once were they able to make the postseason. Can you imagine a five-game series with those two? You have Sale on the mound twice in a short five-game series, what the White Sox could have done. So it was just, when Sale was here, it was just a painful reminder to me of what could have been with those guys.
All you had to do with those two was get in.
Get in.
Get in, and you have a chance to win any series because those two pitchers would combine to start four games.
Painful. Painful reminder.
Cubs back in the playoffs 3 years in a row. The first time they've done that since 1906, 1907, 1908. Kevin and I both cover the team. I was there in 2015 when they lost in the NLCS to the Mets, and they all said collectively, we'll be back. They come back in 16, win the whole thing. You were in St. Louis, I imagine. An awesome scene again. I like the video of Joe Maddon pouring champagne all over himself.
Everybody was talking about that. I didn't actually see Maddon do that. Was that in the clubhouse or was that on the field?
He popped open the cork, looked around, and then poured the bottle of champagne. It was like he took a shower and wiped under the pitch.
Well, I heard people talking about that. The way it works is the media lines up near the clubhouse while they're celebrating. It's a long, long line in the, you know, in the bowels of the stadium, of the ballpark, and we're all just sort of waiting there. So you kind of miss that initial celebration because everybody wants to get in the clubhouse first, and then they open the door to the clubhouse, and it's like a bull just, you know, pouncing out of the cage. Us media members pile into the clubhouse. You know what it's like, Sam.
Yeah, it's
so I missed the front end of that, and then we get in there, and it's chaos, and it's beautiful chaos, and it's fun.
It was 2013. I was at Wrigley. I believe it was 13. On back-to-back days, the Braves and the Pirates both clinched in the visitors' clubhouse at Wrigley. Now the celebrations are on the other side, and the Cubs are the ones celebrating. We'll talk about that. Also, I am super confused about this Carlos Rodon situation. We'll get into that, too. He had arthroscopic shoulder surgery. That's a power pitcher who has a bad shoulder, and they're trying to sugarcoat it.
And we haven't even gotten to the breaking news.
Right, yes.
Which is linebacker Danny Trevathan suspended 2 games for his hit on Devontae Adams Thursday night in Green Bay.
I know how you feel about this.
Yes.
And you got into a social media war.
Yes, and I go out of my way to avoid confrontation on Twitter because I think it's ridiculous arguing with people that you don't even know, you can't even see. It's just dumb. But this one I had to take a strong stand on. The suspension is warranted, right? It's fine. My point was this. When he laid that hit, I said it was illegal. That's an illegal hit in 2017 NFL.
It's a dirty hit. I don't think he's a dirty player, but that was a dirty hit.
See, I don't think it was a dirty hit. I honestly do not think it
he went crown to crown.
For me to be dirty, that means you had to have malicious intent there. Danny Trevathan did not. He was trying to put down a receiver who was still chugging his feet. Everyone keeps talking about it like he was just, you know, being held up in the air waiting to be hit by another player. It wasn't like that. Watch the replay over and over. Devontae Adams is still chugging his feet. He could have broke that tackle. Now, was it unfortunate? Of course. You don't want to see somebody get hurt like that. But Trevathan, if you watch that, and I've watched it over and over and over again, Trevathan looked like he was aiming for the midsection of Devontae Adams, and then by the time he had connected, Adams was brought down closer to Trevathan's helmet. Like, I don't think when he was engaging in that hit, he said, I'm going headhunting here. I don't. So that's why I don't think it was dirty. The outcome ended up looking very dirty. It was illegal because you can't do that in the NFL. But I can't call that a dirty hit when I don't believe there was malicious intent.
I don't know. I'm malicious. Watching it right now on malicious. Loop. He literally ran up full speed and cracked him in the helmet. And then the mouthpiece goes flying. Adams goes to the hospital. Couldn't feel his extremities for hours on end. It's a dirty result. Do we agree with that? It's a dirty result.
Okay, I can roll with that.
I'm with you that Danny Trevathan is not a headhunter, right, but like, sometimes you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I don't think Trevathan was even aiming for the head of Adams.
Maybe not.
I don't think he was, but the way the speed at which the game is played, that was the result. That happened, okay? So the end result may have appeared to be dirty. It was illegal, but I don't think Trevathan had malicious intent here.
The issue is they were down 21-7 going in again. It was third and goal for the Packers. They were about to punch it in again. And Trevathan, after the Bears were down right away, I mean, it was 21-0 in the blink of an eye. This team was frustrated. And I'm not going to say it was on purpose, but there's a reason he got bonged for two games. Here's the language, the email from the NFL. Danny Trevathan of the Chicago Bears has been suspended without pay for two games for a violation of a safety-related playing rule in Thursday night's game against the Green Bay Packers. John Runyon, who's the president of football operations, he issued the suspension for a violation of Rule 12, Section 2, which states, quote, "There shall be no unnecessary roughness. This shall include, but not limited to, using any part of a player's helmet or face mask to butt, spear, or ram an opponent violently or unnecessarily." Now, the helmet went into the helmet. He rammed him violently. I mean, that's literally the rule.
Right, but like that language is hilarious to me.
I agree.
It's the NFL.
But
every
rules
hit
are rules.
Is violent.
Rules are rules.
Our Bears insider Adam Hoge was in Green Bay for that game. He's still in Wisconsin. He was at the Northwestern game in Madison, which was a loss. We'll check in with Adam Hoge next here on 720 WGN.
I don't think I hit him in the helmet, but, you know, I leave that up to those guys. I think I was just right here. I saw the hit, but it wasn't intentionally, not at all. You know, it wasn't trying to break his neck, you know, trying to make the play. He's trying to get in the end zone. You know, my speed was picked up, you know, and I just tried to make a tackle.
Bears linebacker Danny Trevathan bringing you back to the beach, 720 WGN, Panionovich and Powell. 312-981-7200.
Two games for Trevathan for that.
Two-game suspension. The question of the day, and we'll keep this trend rolling throughout the show. You can call, you can text. Keep those texts rolling in. Worst Bears quarterback you ever saw? Question mark.
Long list of them. We want to hear it because we've watched some really, really bad football from Mike Glennon the first four games of the season. Who's the worst Bears quarterback you've ever seen?
Jonathan Quinn.
Cade McNown.
Oh, there's a lot. You can go through the list. Henry Burris.
312-981-7200. Adam Hoge is live from State Street Brats in Madison. That's according to your Twitter account, Adam. Fresh off that Northwestern game, which was a frustrating loss. But obviously the breaking news with Danny Trevathan. Your thoughts on the two-game suspension, Adam?
Yeah, kind of what I thought, guys. I thought two games made sense. He doesn't have a history of this. You know, kind of the thing I locally have compared it to for, well, I guess Chicago fans are on the other side of this in this situation. But when Marian Hossa got nailed by Rafi Torres a few years ago in the playoffs, that was kind of like the other side of this where it's, where you're going, all right, well, that was so egregious that you got to do something about it, right? But the difference being, Rafi Torres obviously had a long history of dirty hits and things that he had been suspended for in the past, fines, things like that. In Danny Trevathan's case, he is not a malicious player or guy. He's a hard hitter. He does have a reputation for that, but he does have a reputation as a headhunter. So I really felt like, look, it was a bad hit. It was clearly illegal. And I do think he should have been suspended for it because I think you have to send the message to the rest of the league that those kinds of hits are not going to stand anymore. And now he'll get a chance to appeal it with his reputation. Maybe he can get it down to one game, which I think would be fair too. And then you move on from there.
Is there an appeal process here, Adam? Do you think he will appeal? Yeah. And if that's the case, can he play Monday night against Minnesota?
So there is an appeal process. He gets 3 days to appeal, and then they, you know, it'll all happen before the next game. And he's going to get at least one game out of this. So he probably will not play against Minnesota.
All right, so they won't have any good linebackers out there against the Vikings. That's awesome.
They're running thin.
Yeah.
Well, more importantly is, Mitch Trubisky is going to start. When are they going to announce that he's the starter, Adam? How long are they going to wait?
Yeah, I've been kind of thinking about this. So my guess would be that it's not a normal week. So on a normal week, they would wait till Wednesday's practice, right? Because that's when you get into game mode. That's when you finally get out there and you have the injury report that's required by the league to put out there and things like that. So that's usually when they would say, all right, this is maybe where we're making the change. So with a Monday night game, that will be Thursday. That's kind of the day I'm thinking will be when they announce it, but they do have a practice on Tuesday, and so maybe it comes earlier in the week just because of this long layoff. I don't really know. I would advise, not that public relations should have any impact on the decisions you're making as a franchise, but at this point, it's pretty obvious that they're probably going to make a change. And I would just advise that get it out there as early as possible. Try to get as much interest in this game as possible, because if you let this thing bleed out throughout the week, God forbid, even said that Mike Glennon is still the starter, that is going to make for bad optics on Monday Night Football when the Cubs are going to be playing the Nationals at Wrigley Field the same day. And if Glennon's starting, what is that place going to be, half full?
Adam, whose call is it? Whose call has it been to not play Trubisky, and whose call is it to put him in as the starting quarterback? Is it Ryan Pace or is it John Fox? Whose voice carries more weight when it comes to that decision?
Well, it's the general manager. There's no question about that. I think what I've been kind of struggling with is sort of understanding how much John Fox wants to continue to play Mike Glennon. I do think that a lot of this has been Ryan Pace and his perfect plan that he thought would unfold, where he could buy a year here to develop Mitch Trubisky, or at least half a season, you would have thought, by having Mike Glennon go out there and manage the game, right? No one thought that Mike Glennon would be this bad. I remember when I first heard at the NFL Combine in February that the Bears were going after Mike Glennon, and I thought it was crazy. I didn't think it made a lot of sense. I said, why not just keep Jay Cutler around? And then when they signed him for more money that Jay Cutler was going to make, I was just like flabbergasted. But I still was looking at him like, all right, well, I don't really agree with the process or the way they went about this, but Mike Glennon should be able to go out there and move the football. He was never this bad in Tampa. And when they draft Trubisky, I'm like, okay, you know, he's coming from a different offense. He's going to have an adjustment to the league. I think he has a high ceiling, but I understood the process. The problem is Glennon has not been able to manage games at all. He's turning the ball over. He can't do that. He's been terrible. I heard you guys asking the question coming into this segment, who's the worst Bears quarterback ever?
He's up there.
I don't think Glennon is the worst among some of those guys you mentioned, but he's played like that. He has played like the worst. We forget he had a 0.0 passer rating in the first preseason game.
Right, and I'm tired of people calling him a game manager, because he's not a game manager. He's just a bad quarterback. A game manager is a guy who doesn't turn the ball over, and that's all he's done.
Yeah, and you can't do that. And so to get back to your question, like, I really think a lot of this is coming from above John Fox. And that this was Ryan Pace's plan, and John has been kind of that's the other thing I'm saying. Like, I don't know what has really been going through John Fox's head the last few weeks. He never tells us anything, as you guys know, in his press conferences. When he wanted to make a change a couple weeks ago, I don't know. I find it hard to believe that any head coach would not have made a change in the middle of the game on Thursday night with how bad that was going. So was he being told from above that he couldn't? I guess I don't know, but that seems to me like the only explanation for how any head coach in that situation couldn't have made a change in a game that seemed like it was still in reach, like when it was 14-0 or 21-7 at the half. That game still felt winnable. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but it felt winnable if you made a change of quarterback. And they basically just conceded, and it got even worse in the fourth quarter when they didn't even try to onside kick or throw the ball. They were just running the clock out, even though they were the team that was losing.
I would put John Fox, I would put Mike Glennon on a barge, put him in Lake Michigan, and just let it sail away. Honestly, at this point, man, I'm so done with it. Last thing, Adam, and we appreciate your time here, and I know you're having a blast at Alma Mater up in Madison right now. Virginia McCaskey hates losing to the Packers. Ryan Pace can feel the pressure, but I think the most telling point about this entire thing is that you read the tea leaves and the quotes out of the locker room, and when a guy like Akeem Hicks, who a lot of people look up to on the defense, when he sort of acknowledges that they need to make a change on offense, that tells me everything I need to know. The locker room has lost faith in Mike Glennon, and it's that simple. Once they lose faith, it's time to move on.
That might be the number one reason why I do think that they are going to go to Trubisky here. I don't know. Look, if you talk to any player in the history of football, they might say the right things when they're talking to the media and, oh, we just got to do our job. We can't worry about the offense. But you talk to any player ever. Sure, the defense gets frustrated with the offense if they're not moving the football and they're turning it over. It's not easy to come back right back out on the field after a turnover. And so I thought that those quotes from Akeem Hicks, who very strategically put that into an answer that wasn't, the question really wasn't about the quarterbacks, but that was a very interesting quote from him the other day where he said, hopefully we make the changes that need to be made. I thought it was very significant, and I agree with you that I can't tell you for sure that that's what he was talking about, but it sure seemed like it, and I was standing right next to him when he said that. So I feel like the locker room, well, how could they not? I mean, we're all watching the same thing. The locker room understands that Mike Glennon has been terrible, and they have to be thinking that Mitch Trubisky is the only right quarterback that could be out there against the Vikings on Monday night next week.
That's Adam Hogue on Twitter, at Adam Hogue. The coverage, WGNRadio.com/Bears and the Hogue and Johns podcast. Have some fun tonight, huh?
Have a brat and a beer for me, Adam.
Yeah, I'm about to. I think it's, it was a tough game for the Cast today, but they fought back. And with no football tomorrow, for me at least, no Bears football, this is, being back in Madison, it's not bad.
I don't think you could take another loss, man. Bears Thursday, Cats today. You need a break.
Yeah, go have some fun, man. Relive the glory days.
Guys.
That's Adam Hogue
right,
from Madison. He covered the Cats and the Badgers today. The Cats took it on the chin, and they lost as well. Ned Coletti, former baseball general manager. He was with the Dodgers for a long time. He's from Chicago. He's got a new book. It's called The Big Chair, about building a baseball team. We'll ask him how the Cubs have done. We'll ask him about what the Sox are doing. He's a lifer in baseball. That's next, but we'll take a quick timeout. News coming up. Then Ned Coletti on 720 WGN. Thank you, Bob. It's 440 on the beat, 720 WGN. These texts rolling in. Worst Bears quarterback you ever saw, 312-981-7200. Peter Tom Willis, Caleb Haney, Will Fuhrer. I didn't even know who Will Fuhrer was.
No clue.
He played one game in 1992. Jim Harbaugh had 13, and Will Fuhrer had one. So keep those coming in, 312-981-7200. Joining us now on the phones, he's a Chicago guy. He started his baseball career working for the Cubs in the 80s, and he's now a senior advisor, with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And the new book is called The Big Chair. We welcome Ned Coletti back to WGN Radio. Hey, Ned, how's it going?
Hey, doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on today.
You're a Chicago guy. Who's the worst quarterback you ever saw for the Bears? Curveball for you.
Both, yeah. I may have a couple more lists for you.
That's a nice dodge by you. So you've been with the Dodgers for a while. This year, a very special season, 102 wins, another division crowd. Your team is the favorite in Vegas. What's this journey been like this year in 2017?
It's been a very amazing year. They just got done losing 16 out of 17 and 20 out of 25 after having maybe the greatest 80-game stretch ever. They were relentless in their approach. They've been really waiting for this month of October to get going since the last time they played in Chicago in October a year ago. I think that left a bitter taste in their mouth, and I think they seem very determined to make amends for getting beat by the Cubbies last year.
Well, growing up in Chicago, obviously your allegiance is with the Dodgers, but what was it like seeing the Cubs win the World Series for you?
You know, it was amazing to me. Might have been the greatest 10 days of my baseball career. After we were eliminated and I could no longer root for the Dodgers at that point in time. I came back for 3, 4, and 5 at Wrigley and then went on to Cleveland for 6 and 7. And the whole experience being at Wrigley Field, in fact, I talk about this a little bit in the book, being at Wrigley Field for the sixth game of the LCS, I had my uncle to my right, who was 83 years old and who wasn't allowed to go to the 45 World Series because he was too young. My dad and my two other uncles wouldn't take him. And to my left a year ago was my son. So we had this three-generational gap. And as we got to the ninth inning, and as you recall, Cubs were 5-0, place was on fire. I mean, people were so revved up. And you know, you can tell when you've seen as much baseball as I have, you can tell when a game is going one way or the other most of the time. And I knew we were just outs away from packing up. I looked at my uncle and I said, "How you feeling about all this?" I mean, he was almost in tears. And he says, "You better not screw this up now, pal." So I said, "If you're watching the game, don't worry about it. We're not going to."
I get chills hearing stories like that. You know, for a lot of us who, you know, Sam and I cover sports, we're around sports, we love sports. For me, it was always like, I wanted to be a professional athlete as a kid. And then you get a little older and you realize, well, that's not going to happen. But I told myself, I have to be around sports. I have to do something involving sports because I love it. I love baseball. I love football. I love it all. Was that the case for you? Did you want to be a player? Like, where did the root of all this come from? When did you realize, okay, maybe playing as a professional athlete is not going to happen, so maybe I can do something else in the sports industry?
Exactly the same path. My first game at Wrigley was April 15th, 1961. I can remember it vividly. And I caught the bug as a little kid. And I love the Cubs. I love baseball. Ernie Banks, my favorite player, first player I ever got an autograph from. Got to know Ron Santo later in life, both as a player and then when I was working for the Cubs and he was broadcasting, we became very, very close. So the seeds of my career were kind of planted at that point in time, hanging out in the bleachers at Wrigley Field. But at 5'8", I knew I wasn't going to become a professional athlete.
Hey, so Jose Altuve is doing pretty good. He's about 5'6". He may win the MVP.
I root for him every day because of that. But I went to Triton. I went to East Lydon High School. Went to Triton College for a couple years, JC. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college, so we really didn't have a roadmap educationally. Then I graduated from Northern Illinois with a degree in journalism, and I wrote sports. Like you broadcast and you talk about it on the air, I wrote sports for about 4 years, went to Philly, covered the NHL for a little while. My dad got sick back in Franklin Park, and I came home, and fortunately Dallas Green and Bob Ivock, who was the PR director at the time, brought me back and gave me an opportunity to start my career and also be with my dad in his final days. He died later that year in 1982 and hang with my mom, who was going through a tough time, and my brother, who does Bears stats for decades now, was still at Northern Illinois. So a tough time in my life turned out to be a blessing in a few other ways when my dad died.
Ned Coletti with us on the beat, 720 WGN, a sports executive for the Los Angeles Dodgers. The new book, The Big Chair, The Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces from the Inside World of the Dodgers. We'll talk about that coming up. But I had a question about Tommy Lasorda, the influence he still has with the Dodgers. How important is he, and how influential is he still to this day in Los Angeles?
Well, he just turned 90 the other day, and he's probably the in a lot of ways the face of generations in L.A. of baseball, including Vin Scully, who retired last year after 67 years of doing the games on TV and radio. Tommy is iconic in so many ways, was a big help for me. He hated the fact that I worked for the Giants before I worked for the Dodgers. I said, I couldn't help that. And then I actually had the great honor of having dinner with Frank Sinatra one night when I was working for the Cubs. And we got around to talking about sports, and Frank says, "You know, I love Tommy Lasorda, you know, I'm very close to Tommy, but I grew up a Giants fan. And So I kind of kept that in the back of my mind. And one night, the Giants are playing the Dodgers, and Tommy's giving Brian Sabia and I a hard time about something. And I look at him. I said, "Hey, you know, one time I heard that Frank Sinatra was actually a Giants fan." And he goes, and he went off. I mean, it was like one of those moments where you say, and he actually threw us out of the booth because he was so upset that I would be so blasphemous with Frank's loyalty. Although I told him at the end, I said, you know, I got this from a pretty good source. I got it from the man himself, you know. But Tommy's a very, very good friend and somebody who loves Chicago. I tell you what, he spends, especially in his 70s and 80s, as much time as he could spend in the city of Chicago, he would.
All right. Can you share us any more stories about Frank Sinatra? What was that like hanging out with him?
Casually, yeah. Dinner with Sinatra, no big deal.
It was actually set up by another Chicagoan, the great comedian Tom Dreesen.
Yep.
And I had helped Tom with tickets for a long time for Wrigley Field stuff, and he was a huge Cub fan. Actually, I got him to be a bat, not Frank, but Tom, I got him to be a bat boy with the Cubs. He was like 40 years old, and he always had this dream. So I had to go to Don Zimmer and Jimmy Fry and say, I got a bat boy candidate. And they said, "Is he old enough to drive?" I says, "Yes, by about 25, 26 years, it's Tom Dreesen." And they just kind of rolled their eyes, you know, but... He had a show in San Francisco. I was working for the Cubs. I had no allegiance to the Giants at the time. And he invited myself and a guest, and I brought our old pitching coach, Billy Connors, with me. And went out to the show with Tom and then came back. And I had always wanted to meet Sinatra. And Tom was a little bit leery, and he says, you know, Frank's a little bit edgy sometimes. And, you know, he doesn't want to just meet people that he doesn't know ahead of time or know that he's going to meet them. So I don't think we're going to be able to do this. So I get a little agitated with Tom. I mean, I've left him about 2,000 tickets by this time, you know. And so we're driving back to the city in San Francisco, and we go to this restaurant, and he says, you know, you guys have to go back to the hotel. I said, "Tom, you can't even say let us say hello to the man." He says, "Well, let me see if he's okay." So they close this restaurant down for the Sinatra party. So we go in there, and he says, "Yeah, come on back, get in line with the owner, the maitre d', the chef, say hello, then you got to go." So that's what we did. And as we're walking out of this private room, Sinatra goes, "Where are you guys going?" And I said, "Well, we're just going to go back to the team hotel. We were introduced as members of the Cub organization." I said, "We're just going back to the team hotel." He says, "You're not staying for dinner?" I says, "No, we just wanted to go back, you know." And he says, "So you're going to insult me?" And so I looked at Dreesen, and I said, "Mr. Sinatra, I'll never insult you. We're going to stay." I looked at Dreesen, and I says, "There you go, buddy. How are we doing so far?"
The problem is when you go to dinner with Sinatra, you're up until 5 in the morning, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. And being from the Midwest at that point in time, it was 7 in the morning. So when I did get out of that dinner, it was about 3 or 4 hours long. It was unbelievable. It was like a dream almost. And then, you know, I got out and I got back to the team hotel. Cell phones weren't even around yet. I got back to the team hotel and called all the buddies I grew up with and all my uncles who grew up with Sinatra and Martin and the Rat Pack and all that, and said, "Guess what I did last night?" You know, so a cool night.
Your best, your favorite Ron Santo story?
Oh, goodness. I have so many. Ronnie, I had Ronnie almost arrested one night in Philadelphia. We were on the team bus the night before and coming back, and he says, you know, no, the day before. And he says, you know, I'm going to stay in a clubhouse tonight. We're going to watch this heavyweight fight on closed circuit TV. So I know where he's going to be when the game's over. So he watches the fight, and I hear from, might have been Tom Brenneman. I hear from Brenneman that says, Ronnie had a tough time coming back from the fight at the fight in the clubhouse, coming back to the team hotel. The cab driver took him to the wrong place, so he really got on this cab driver. So we get on the bus, and we're driving to the stadium now the next afternoon, and I got Brenneman sitting next to me, and Ronnie's behind me. I know he can hear me. I go, "Hey, how about the new ordinance they got in Philly where you got to be very, very kind to cab drivers, and you can't be abusive, you can't shortchange them, you got to tip them well and treat them with the utmost respect. Otherwise, you know, you can actually go to jail." And Brenneman goes, yeah, I heard that. Now, you know, boy, it's can be a little touchy from time to time. You know, he's not letting on that he was with Ronnie last night. And I hear Ronnie, I can see Ronnie kind of like getting a little closer to hear the conversation. So we got to the vet. They were in the old ballpark. Then we got to the vet, and the stadium operations guy for the Phillies was a dear friend of mine, Mike. And I said, "Hey, you got a couple security guys that can come in here and jostle Ronnie a little bit?" He goes, "Oh, I'd love to." So between innings, second and third inning, two policemen show up. and they got a piece of paper rolled up, and they walk into the booth as soon as the inning ends, and they go, Mr. Ron Santo here? And Ronnie's sitting down like three steps down from the hallway, and he goes, yeah, I'm Ron Santo. And he, you know, and he looks like he's going to sign something for the guy, you know, like an autograph. And the guy says, we're here to arrest you after you, how disrespectful you were to a City of Philadelphia cab driver last night. And Ronnie, I mean, this is like there's an inning, there's like a 30-second break, you know, a 60-second break, right? And Ronnie's going, hey, the guy took us the wrong way. This guy deserved everything I gave. And he starts screaming at the policeman. And the guy says, let's go. We're going right now. Because now Ronnie starts to get a little bit belligerent with the policeman trying to defend himself. It was all a made-up skit. And now I'm standing behind the policeman, and I'm laughing so hard. And he sees me, and he you know, used to call me an affectionate Italian nickname, you know. And he says, I says, all right, we were just playing. And my now, you know, they're back on the air. And Ronnie's still not on the air because he's up in the hallway yelling at me for the policeman, you know. But Ronnie was one of my dearest friends. I know him since I was 10 years old. He come back to the – when I grew up in Franklin Park, we had an Italian delicatessen there, still there, Alan Joe's. And Ronnie would come there and buy some prosciutto. I was 10. He was probably 24, 25 years old, starting to really get his career to take off, and became friends at that point in time.
You get to know these players pretty well, too. We're talking with Ned Colletti, a baseball executive for the Dodgers. Judd Surratt told me a story that he talked about with you about Deonor Navarro, about all the pets he had. Didn't he have, like, a tiger and a bunch of pigs? Didn't he have all these crazy animals that he used to have in his house?
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, there's always a different story. There's always, you know, people, we think we meet, when we meet people, like that's the first day that their life started, and we're, you know, we're always wrong because they have so much different things that went on, you know, in their past. I'm pretty sure it was Navarro. I've had a couple guys that had collections of exotic animals, and of course, as time goes on, they start collecting cars.
Cameron Lowe had snakes. Yeah. He would bring a snake into the clubhouse and scare Alfonso Soriano to death.
You know, the craziest thing I ever had to put into a contract, Rafael Furcal, who I signed in L.A. a couple times to be our shortstop. When a player signed a pretty hefty contract, they would always give money back to the Dodgers Dream Foundation, much like they probably did the Cubs Care in the day and still do. And he said, I'm going to match this. I want to match what I'm giving you. I want you to help me match something and help me do something. I said, what would that be? He says, in the town I grew up in, the DR, there's no fire department, no fire truck. Can you help me get a fire truck? I said, you got it. So we got a fire truck that they were retiring in L.A., had it painted in Dodger blue with Rafael Furcal's facsimile signature across the front. And then Tommy, of course, had all the connections and all sorts of ways of the world. And so we got it shipped down to the little town of Dominican where Rafael Furcal grew up.
That's outstanding.
You are just full of stories. You are full of them.
It says there's a fire truck. Yeah.
That's incredible. Ned Colletti with us on the beat a couple more minutes here. The book, The Big Chair, The Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces, Wednesday, October 2nd. There's a signing here in Chicago, Sulzer Regional Library, 4455 North Lincoln Avenue. You can meet Ned at 7 o'clock. What was the smoothest hop? What was the worst bounce for you?
Well, some of the worst bounces, unfortunately, happened in Chicago. And I was a young executive beginning my negotiation journey when Greg Maddux left the Cubs. So there's great detail, almost a step-by-step detail when Greg left for Atlanta way back when. Also when Andre Dawson, this is a smoother hop, not for the front office at the time, but certainly for Andre Dawson, when he did come to the Cubs, a negotiation that took place. If you remember, he signed a very low-valued contract, and then baseball was hit with collusion right after that. But my time with the Hawk is canonical in there, as well as signing Sandberg to his four-year, $28 million contract. That's some of the Cubs stuff in there. Some smooth, some a little rocky from time to time. But it gets into a lot of the trades, a lot of the different things. I mean, back in L.A., we acquired Manny Ramirez at the last minute for the people of the Dodger lore, or even baseball, who love to find out what happens inside the room. What does it look like? Almost like the X-ray. We got the story of Manny, and then we traded for Adrian Gonzalez and Beckett. Few guys, a lot of signing stories like Greinke, Ryu, Puig, but also a lot of Cub things, because that's where I cut my teeth, and that's where my love for baseball began, right at Clark and Addison, 50-some years ago.
You are full of stories. I wish we had more time. Ned Colletti, the author of The Big Chair, and he's still in the front office for the Dodgers. Good luck with L.A. until you meet the Cubs in the NLCS.
You.
And we will talk to you. The book signing is Wednesday, October 2nd, here in Chicago at Sulzer Regional Library, 4455 North Lincoln Avenue. Go see Ned Colletti at 7 o'clock. Thanks, Ned.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me on today.
Thank Quick timeout, 720 WGN.
Outstanding performance tonight. We needed that. The way Waka was throwing, if we didn't have a stellar performance from our starter, that game would probably have been over. So that was a great outing by Johnny.
That's the architect of this Chicago Cubs team. Theo Epstein in St. Louis for the clincher Wednesday night. This is The Beat on WGN. I'm Kevin Powell. He's Sam Panayotovic. I think we should talk about John Lackey a little bit. Midway through that celebration, all of a sudden it got dead silent in the clubhouse at Busch Stadium. And John Lester and Rizzo had called everybody to the corner of the clubhouse. And it was, you know, you heard the music in the background there behind Theo. And it was like a club in there. It was wild. And anyways, they bring everyone to the corner of the clubhouse. And Lester starts giving the speech. And he gets pretty emotional. And then that's when he revealed that that was probably John Lackey's final regular season start. And everyone's like, okay, well, we've been asking Lackey all year if retirement is looming. And Lackey, who hates the media, wouldn't answer it.
I don't think they like him either, for the record.
Lackey would, who's talking about retirement? I never said anything about retirement. And everyone sort of knew. It's like, okay, really? This is your
that actually sounded like
that
Lackey.
Did sound. Kind of, I know
it did.
I kind of surprised myself there with that Lackey impression. Everyone knew. Everyone sort of knew. Like, okay, where are you going to go? The Cubs aren't going to bring John Lackey back, right? I mean, this is his last year on the deal. And Lackey looks at the media after Lester had revealed that, had said this was probably his final regular season start. And he, you know, they take their swigs or their Budweiser and their champagne. John Lester's a Miller Lite guy, so he was drinking Miller Lite, my kind of guy. And he talks to his teammates and he sort of points at the media and he goes, well, I'm not gonna say anything in front of these guys. I'll talk to you boys on the bus. So, and then I did hear John Lackey moments later say to someone, I'm going out the same way I came in. And Lackey won a World Series with the Angels in 2002, his rookie season. So that's, I think, what he was implying there. The point is, John Lackey's career is going to be over after this run. He's sort of the, for as much as, and Theo, after that, we actually talked a little bit more about Lackey with Theo. And he said, look, I know he comes off a certain way to the media. I know even fans, even Cub fans, don't necessarily like John Lackey all that much. But it's just how he is. But Theo said that John Lackey's beloved in the clubhouse. And I believe him. The way they were chanting his name and embracing him in the clubhouse. And I don't know how you feel about this, Sam, but covering the team now for a couple of years and being around them, Anthony Rizzo is certainly like the face of the team, probably the heartbeat of the Cubs.
I think he's the most important in the room.
Yeah, but I would say that the biggest leaders, like when they talk, everyone listens, are Lackey, Lester, and Arrieta.
And last year it was Ross. Last year
Ross
was
big,
up there
big
too.
Time too. But those three pitchers to me have always had a presence in the clubhouse. Like if they're talking, everyone in that clubhouse is listening. They all kind of follow their lead. They're veterans. They know that they can kind of let Rizzo be the face of the franchise and things like that. But when those guys speak up, everyone listens. And John Lackey, I've never heard a bad thing said about him by anybody within the Cubs organization, whether it's the players or the front office. They love him. So John Lackey has this persona in the public, in the media, that he's just a real negative dude, and he's angry, and he's bitter all the time, and he hates the media. But in the clubhouse, they love John Lackey.
I don't think his ex-wife likes him all that much, and I'm not going to get into it, but he is...
Sam, making it personal with Lackey.
He is the model of consistency on the mound. When you look at his win total, in 2003, his first full-time starting season, 10 wins. After that, 14, 14, 13, 19, 12, 11, 14, 12, 10, 14, 11, 13, 11, 12. Double-digit wins. He takes the ball every fifth day. Say what you want about the way he treats the media. That's fine. You know, it is what it is. It's been chronicled. It's been talked about.
Doesn't hurt my feelings.
It doesn't change my life. I will get over it. I will move on. what he does for those young guys is he shows them what it takes to be a durable major league guy.
Yeah, he's a legitimate big-time professional baseball player.
And a big
he knows
game
what
pitcher.
It takes.
Did it in Los Angeles, did it in Boston, did it with the Cardinals.
He did it on in Wednesday night. That was he was outstanding Wednesday night in that clincher, and they needed that. You got to give him a lot of credit there. Some more sound from the locker room. Tom Ricketts was there enjoying a little champagne. Had this to say about Theo and the guys.
Obviously, Theo stepped up and made some great trades, and the guys all started playing a little better. And, you know, once again, credit to the guys. I mean, you know how hard it is to repeat. You know how hard it is to get back. You know, most World Series teams don't get back to win their division, and our guys just did a great job.
Let's not forget where the Cubs were at the All-Star break. Remember where they were at, Sam?
4.5 behind Milwaukee?
Yeah, I think they're 5.5 back,
okay.
If I'm not mistaken. 5 games under .500? They were under .500 at the All-Star break. Cub fans were panicking.
Well, that's because the team celebrated in April and May and in June. And that's fine. You have every reason to do what you did because you broke the biggest curse
right.
in the history of American sports. It's warranted. It's fine. They didn't kick it into gear until July. And here's why it works. And I took this note the other day, and we talked before the show. Theo Epstein, since he took over in 2011, has done literally everything he has said he was going to do. Everything he said this team would do, he's accomplished. Sustained success, perennial contenders, making the necessary trades. Who thought that he would acquire Jose Quintana from the White Sox?
Mm-hmm.
He's flipped younger players for more important pieces. He signed the big fish. Has he whiffed yet in free agency? No.
Well, I believe, didn't he sign Edwin Jackson?
I mean, on the big fish that
I know
made
it didn't
this,
matter in the grand scheme of things, but that was a horrible
contract. No, you needed innings eaters at that point, and
that's
at that
true.
Time, you just needed guys to go out there and
that's
throw
true.
200 innings.
He's hit on pretty much everything.
He hit on John Lester, Jason Hayward, Ben Zobrist. You might not win a World Series without Ben Zobrist. And say what you want about Aroldis Chapman. He's a bad dude, but without Aroldis Chapman, you don't win that World Series. And he traded a lot of high-profile pieces to get Aroldis Chapman. So Theo Epstein, plain and simple, has done everything he told you he was going
to
do.
Yeah, and I like his approach to it where it's, you know, he constantly says winning is sacred. An opportunity to win is sacred. Some people, and I'm serious, people were calling, okay, are the Cubs going to be sellers at the trade deadline? And I'm like, what are you talking about?
I thought they would consider flipping Wade Davis. I thought that was the only thing I thought. If they were to bottom out and be 9-10 games under, you could consider flipping Wade Davis. I wouldn't have sold.
You're probably right. You're
because
probably
he's
right.
Probably not going to be back. I don't think they're going to sign him at the end of the
Wade
season
Davis,
because they believe Carl Edwards Jr. is the closer of the future.
Wade Davis, by the way, you could make an argument that he's maybe the MVP of the team this year. Where would the Cubs be without Wade Davis? Where would that bullpen be without Wade Davis, who's been absolutely dominant? That's been bullpens, you don't feel that comfortable about the bullpen, do you?
If I were to tell you back in April, your two most consistent relievers would be Wade Davis and Brian Dunsing, what would you have said?
Davis, I would believe that. I mean, look at Davis's numbers and how the past few years he's been one of the best closers in baseball. He's right there.
We're talking Cubs baseball on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. The first game of the NLDS, that'll be on October 6th. It's a Friday. Cubs will be at the Nationals. We still don't know who will start in that first game. Let's go out and talk to Jim on 720 WGN. Hey, Jim, welcome.
Hi, guys. You know, Major League Baseball set more strikeout records this year, and we got three guys that are very worrisome come playoff time with Brian Schwarber and Baez. You know, can a leopard change its spots, or are those going to be holes when the pitching is better than the hitting in playoff time?
Well, Jim, I look at who they beat last year in the playoffs. They beat Johnny Cueto. They beat Corey Kluber. They beat Clayton Kershaw. They didn't technically beat Madison Bumgarner, but he didn't beat them. These guys, they have the it factor in these big games, and I'm with you. But they struck out last year a lot. They struck out in 2015 a lot. They're going to strike out. That's how their offense is built. They still have that boom potential, though. Like the Javi Baez home run against the Giants in Game 1. You know, Miguel Montero struck out a lot, but he had the grand slam. Baez had a home run in Game 7. So, yes, the strikeouts will happen, but I think you have to take the good with the bad.
But, Rizzo should be leading by example and saying, hey, you know, two strikes. Remember, every at-bat counts. And, you know, there's still too much free swinging going on.
I don't know if I completely agree with that. If anybody puts good at-bats together, it's Anthony Rizzo.
Yeah, that's what I mean. By example, he chokes up with two strikes. He does what he's supposed to. And why can't it become infectious?
Well, they take a lot of pitches.
I think it is infectious. You look at this offense, when one guy starts hitting, they all start hitting. I think it is infectious with this team.
Well, and the other thing is, in that lineup, when you look at that lineup and how you can construct it, and thanks, Jim, for your call, there are guys in every hole in that lineup, Kev, that can win a game with a big hit. Addison Russell, who had a huge grand slam in the World Series last year, was hitting ninth. Baez could hit seventh. Hayward could hit sixth. You know, and the bats off the bench, too. I mean, they come in and they can hit in big-time situations.
Well, it's stacked. And I think if you're going to beat the Cubs in the postseason, you have to have a really, really good bullpen. Because we saw it postseason last year, that when they were able to get to Kershaw and some of those other guys you mentioned, it's when they see them second or third or fourth time around. So teams that think, I mean, look at Wednesday night. Waka was dealing. The Cubs had two hits through six innings, and then they explode for five runs in the seventh, the third time around when they see the pitcher. So the more pitches they see from an opposing pitcher, the more dangerous they become in the postseason. A team's going to have to go to that bullpen earlier because I don't care who it is. The Cubs got to Kershaw after seeing him a few times around last year, and that's the best pitcher in baseball.
I would probably go Hendricks game one.
Yeah, no question.
Lester game two. Arrieta, Quintana. That's how I would do it. That's how I would structure it.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what they're going to do with John Lackey. Do you give him a start? He's got to be on the playoff roster. From what I saw the other night, the way they rally around him, there's no way they're going to leave John Lackey off the playoff roster.
If they do,
they're not going to.
He's going to give somebody a haircut. 312-981-7200. It's The Beat on 720 WGN.
DJ Dan Long, spitting out the jams.
Express yourself. Man, what a jam. This takes me back. 312-981-7200. It's The Beat, 720 WGN. Sam and Kevin hanging out with you till 7 o'clock. Then it's Blackhawks hockey, the Hawks and the Bruins. That game's on the west side tonight. I love this story. Report, Robin Ventura, one of the early favorites for the Mets managerial position. Why?
Why not?
They wanted somebody that had close ties to the Mets.
He played there for 3 years.
He was on that team in 2000. He was on the Subway Series team. Yeah. Mets and Yankees played in the World Series. He also hit a walk-off. Was it the walk-off like grand slam, but he only touched first base and he got mobbed? It was one of the better moments in Mets history. Doesn't mean he can manage, though.
Terry Collins, their current manager, is going to be, I don't know, is he officially retiring? I know they said he's just not going to be back next year.
I think he's being pushed out.
I'm all for Ventura back in baseball. Bring him back.
I like Robin a lot. The issue with Robin is he didn't win.
He didn't win. Didn't have a ton to work with. But, you know, look what Robin had to deal with when he was with the White Sox. Chris Sale cutting up jerseys. The Drake LaRoche saga.
That was one of the weirdest stories. You were there. You were there when that
Arizona.
Exploded. I remember
like
your coverage.
I went out there. Second day I'm out there. I'm like, okay, what do we got going with the White Sox here? And then all this news broke. We're all like sitting outside the clubhouse at Camelback Ranch.
Well, Kenny flipped on LaRoche's kid.
Yeah, and you can hear like people yelling in there. I heard some stuff being banged. Then we heard laughter. I was like, what is going on here? And then the whole story comes out, and Drake LaRoche is our leader. It was like, this is a freak show.
The issue was, Kenny and Adam LaRoche had a handshake agreement that Adam could bring Drake to all the games. It wasn't in writing. It was just, okay, he could come around.
And then players didn't want the kid around.
Well, you know who it was. Do you know who was finally? Jimmy Rollins.
Yeah, Jimmy Rollins.
Jimmy Rollins walked into that clubhouse and was like, what the?
So I went up to Jimmy Rollins when that all went down.
What is this kid doing here? Why is there a 12-year-old kid in this grown man locker room?
He had his own locker. His own locker in the
clubhouse. He had multiple uniforms.
I went up to Jimmy Rollins right when it happened. This was before I had even heard that Jimmy Rollins was maybe one of the guys not happy with it. And I was like, Jimmy, you talk for a minute? He goes, about what? I go, you know, stuff with Drake and Adam. And he was not having it. He just kind of gave me this nasty look. I'm like, okay, never mind. Have a good day, Jimmy. And then like a couple of days later, that the reports came out that Jimmy Rollins was the one not, which I didn't really even understand. I'm like, Jimmy Rollins? they just signed him that year.
But
like
he was
veteran.
A vet. He'd been around forever, and
yeah,
he did not understand why.
You didn't think a guy like that would carry that much weight, but it didn't help that Adam LaRoche had one of the worst years of his career the season before after getting a huge contract.
Right. If LaRoche was hitting 300 with 40 homers, you could bring everybody.
And everyone, the 2 days later, I'm at Sloan Park, and we asked Rizzo about the situation, and we just bluntly asked him, if he was hitting 300, if he hit 40 homers last year, would you think this would be a problem? He's like, no, it doesn't matter. It's just, if you're good, you can do whatever you want. It's like Aroldis Chapman and the Cubs bringing him to Chicago, even with all that baggage. Doesn't matter. If you can perform on the field, teams will find a spot for you.
Robin Ventura's first season in 2012, 85 wins. That was that late season collapse. The Tigers won the division. Fifth place in 13 with 63 wins. Fourth place in 14, 73 wins. Fourth place in 15, 76 wins. Fourth place in 16, 78 wins. Good luck, Mets. Scott Merkin will join the show after we check news. Merk is out in Cleveland. I have so many questions and so many theories about Carlos Rodon. I'll tell you why I think that this guy, he may be done in Chicago. I don't think I don't think he's going to be here much longer. He's a power pitcher who just underwent shoulder surgery. It's not good. And there's a lot of things they're trying to hide from the press. We'll dive into that. I know Merck's not going to want to touch on it, but I'll dive into it. We'll do that after we check news. But first, we got to step away on 720 WGN.
The prognosis is for a full and complete recovery and him to return back to the pitcher he was. Now, again, anytime you go into someone's shoulder, you do so with the utmost caution, and we don't try to prognosticate too much on what's going to wind up happening. But in terms of what was medically performed and what they saw inside the shoulder, it was as good as we could hope, and he is projected to make a full recovery.
We're halfway home on the beat, 720 WGN, on a busy college football Saturday. I don't think Michigan is playing, though, so that's why Scott Merkin is not glued to his computer or his monitor. He's in Cleveland covering Sox and Tribe. A bye week for the Wolverines, right, Merk?
It is. They get Michigan State at night next Saturday night. That should be one heck of a game.
How excited are you to be done with baseball so you can actually enjoy your guy, Jim Harbaugh, in the season?
I think... luckily, the games have worked out where it's usually like, you know, pregame where I'm finishing stories and all that. But I think during that Purdue game where Michigan didn't really play well to the fourth quarter, other people in the press box got an interesting perspective of my fandom for Michigan football while I was writing and watching at the same time there.
That cut we played coming in, Scott Merkin, MLB.com, White Sox beat writer, was obviously Sox GM Rick Hahn talking about his ace, Carlos Rodon. Arthroscopic shoulder surgery. The recovery, you can't really pinpoint it, but they guessed 6 to 8 months. I loved your follow-up. Wait, will he be ready for opening day? Because they said this year he'd be ready in April. He didn't pitch until June 28th, so I don't really know what to make of this, and I can't believe any timelines with Carlos Rodon going forward.
Well, I think the follow-up that I was trying to get at was I was trying to, you know, see if they were saying that he'll be ready to start doing work opening day or he legitimately could be ready to be part of the rotation on opening day. And there's obviously a big difference there. You know, I mean, so I think the thing with this is you just got to kind of let it play out. There's really almost no, well, there really is no reason to speculate because you just don't know until he starts going through the rehab and starts going through the work and makes progress. And, you know, I think Rick kind of laid that out with his comment that they're not really, I'm paraphrasing, but I think he said they're not really going to know until spring training. So yeah, I think opening day, just anytime, any kind of surgery is probably going to be, you know, a tough target, maybe a little after that. And you know, with Carlos's value to the organization and value as part of this rebuild, they're going to err on the side of caution if there's any sort of doubt, just like they've kind of done in promoting guys, you know, in the system that, you know, until the very last second when they've crossed off all the, you know, or checked off all the boxes and the thing to do list. And I think it's going to be the same thing in Carlos's rehab. So really, you know, aside from knowing that he had arthroscopic surgery, that they're pleased with the results, that they know there's inherent, you know, questions when you go into a pitcher's shoulder, there's really not much more you can say until Rick or someone in the organization says something about it.
Well, it's sort of the first bump in the rebuild road for the White Sox. This year was, I think last I checked, the Sox have the fourth worst record in baseball, which is It's actually a good thing right now because they're going to get a high draft pick. It's a little painful at times to watch some of the baseball they're producing, but it's all part of the plan, Rick Hahn's plan. I don't think this year could have gone really any much better for Hahn and the White Sox. What are your thoughts on that, Mark?
Yeah, I think the only other bump they've had is we can't forget Zach Birdie, who had Tommy John surgery. But, you know, here's the thing. You don't want any pitcher, especially two high-quality performers such as, you know, Rodon, who's shown it at the major league level, and Birdie, who I'm sure will. You don't want to have anyone have surgery. But if there's going to be a setback, probably now is the time to have it. You know, if you had to pick some sort of time, this is a weird comment. I'm not sure I'm going to get out of this one. But, you know, you don't want to ever have problems, but if you're going to have it at the early stages of the rebuild as opposed to 19 and 20 when you're really targeting prime contention.
Right.
As for the entire rebuild, I think it's worked tremendously. You know, obviously, if you're going to trade a guy like Chris Sale, if you're going to trade a guy like Jose Quintana, two great kids, two great pitchers, and great contractual control, then you better get really high-end, almost major league players ready, you know, capable players ready. And they got that. You know, they got that in Yoan Moncada, who is, you know, going to be the starting second baseman for the 2018 year season and has been, you know, for a good part, or since the trade deadline, I guess, right, in this season. You got Lucas Giolito, who's looks like he has found something as much mental as much as physical, kind of a comfort zone that could put him up at the top of the rotation. You got Ronaldo Lopez, who showed strong. And, you know, from everyone you talk to, Eloy Jimenez, man, being the best of the group. So kudos to Rick and Kenny and everyone else who pulled off these deals. And I don't think they're done adding yet. And now is, you know, in part kind of the development part. So now, you know, I know I talked to James Shields a week ago, and he said he thinks they can contend in 2018. But, you know, you still have the Indians in the AL Central, so you're probably talking contending for a wild card. And Rick was very eloquent on that the other day when he said, you know, even if we can sneak up and get into that wild card race, we're not deviating from the plan. And that's, I think, and Sam and Kevin, you guys might agree or disagree on this, but I think the biggest thing on this rebuild that fans love is they're picking a path and they're sticking with the path, and that's what really has people excited.
Well, I think that's the biggest thing for Sox fans, and we're talking with Scott Merkin, the White Sox beat reporter for MLB.com, that when they did go in on this, for years, it just felt like the Sox were stuck in the middle. What are they? You know, they didn't have a foundation in their farm system. They weren't competing on the diamonds. So to pick a path, and you said it perfectly, Mark, to pick a path and just keep go all in on it, I think is refreshing for the White Sox. And two of the trades you mentioned, Chris Sale and Jose Quintana, you know, everybody keeps praising Theo, and rightfully so, for that Wade Davis for Jorge Soler trade and how that was robbery, and we've seen how that's played out. I don't think people are giving Rick Hahn enough for getting what he in return for the Adam Eaton to the Nationals trade. I mean, could not believe how much he got by sending Eaton to the Nationals. You get Lucas Giolito, Ronaldo Lopez, and Dane Dunning. That might have been the best trade of the offseason.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. I heard the deal before it came down, and I put it out there on Twitter that they were trading Adam Eaton, but I saw the talent return and I didn't trust the response on that yet, so I didn't want to put the talent.
I couldn't believe it. Wait a minute, something's broken.
And credit to Mike Rizzo on his side, and he explained that very well at the winter meetings, that he felt like he was trading from an area of depth, the three guys he moved, for a guy they definitely needed, and no one knew that Adam was going to, you know, suffer the knee injury, right, I believe, going into first base. So again, I think Rick did what he needed to do there. Again, another guy who's a top-notch player, a strong leadoff hitter, a good right fielder, and good contractual control, and you got great pieces back. Three guys who, you know, two already have helped at the major league level, and one who certainly will be there probably sooner than later if things keep progressing as they have. And I think you look at the Cubs-Sox trade, which is so, you know, seeming unique in our times, especially a trade of that magnitude. And Kenny Williams mentioned this to me not too long ago, and I think it's just a good baseball trade on both sides. Both sides in that trade got exactly what they needed, and it really helped what they needed. I mean, look at what the Cubs have done since the All-Star break. I'm not saying that Quintana is the sole reason for that, but and then Jimenez and Cease and, you know, of the four guys they got could be huge contributors when the Sox are primed to contend.
I spent a lot of time with Ricky Renteria when he was with the Cubs because I cover both Cubs and Sox, and you've been around him for 2 years now. He was on the staff last year. This is his first full season as a manager. What do you make of Renteria, and is he really the guy long-term? Because some people have doubts.
Yeah, I mean, I think even Ricky, when you talk to him, one thing great about Ricky is he keeps everything, and Robin did this too, you know, he keeps everything on the day focus. He's not worried about what anyone or the team even thinks about him in 2020 or 2021. He's just doing the best job he can right now. Here's the best thing I think about Ricky Renteria is that from the first moment he got this job, you know, what was it, the day after the end of the 2016 season, right? Shortly thereafter, he was in instructional league. Then he was at fall league. And then during spring training, you know, he was back on the minor league side too. He has set this tone of what he wants from the organization. You know, you can talk about these guys don't quit and they play hard every day. Well, sure, that's true, but I think that's kind of incumbent on any kind of professional player. You should give that out there. But I think what Ricky has done above anything else is that he has not changed the culture. I think the culture was bad with Robin or Ozzy or Jerry Manuel or anyone else, but he has done what he wanted and kind of implemented that from day one and not changed. And the voice hasn't changed from anyone on his staff either, who has been also, you know, an excellent group this year. So that's the biggest thing, is his consistency and making clear what he wants from literally day one on this job.
One of the pleasant surprises this year, this is my takeaway, is, and I think most of us will agree here, is what Avi Garcia's been able to do. You know, we were out there in spring training and you looked at him, you're like, wow, something looks different there. And then you hear, you know, he lost 20 pounds, he's in right. good shape, things like that. So he's sort of like in this weird limbo, like he's maybe just a little bit ahead. Like, is he going to be there when they're contenders? Where does he fit into this rebuild for you, Avi Garcia?
Well, I think that's the question. It's hard to say, because that's the question, you know, that Rick has been asked a couple times, and he has given the answer that you'd expect, and that, you know, they like what he's done. They like what Jose, they love what Jose Abreu's done. They have 2 years of control over both of them, so there's no rush to make a decision, but they have to figure out, is, you know, part of this money for the rebuild going to go to extending these guys as part of what they can, you know, what they hope will be multiple championship teams, or do they move them and try and enhance the rebuild for what they have right now? Now, you know, you guys watched in the offseason the kind of power hitting market, you know, and Avi has improved greatly in right field, and Jose's had a solid, you know, probably last two thirds defensively at first base. But the market for kind of power hitters has not been, to use a Rick Hahn word, robust over the last year or so. So I would be beyond stunned if Jose Abreu is not the first baseman for the White Sox to start the 2018 season. I think there's a very good chance Avi is going to be in right field too, but long-term it's kind of hard to say. I will say the thing about Avi is he's come into camp in good shape before, but he kind of had something figured out this year. And you know, you talk to Todd Steverson, the hitting coach, and the biggest thing for him is he's not expanding the zone. And when he does go through periods of expanding the zone, he realizes he's expanding the zone and can get back to his form. People want him to hit with more power, but the key for him has been hitting up the middle and kind of going the opposite way a little bit. And the power will come. He's a big man. You know, he's only, what is he, 26 years old?
Right, that's what I mean. He's at that age where it's like, okay, do you commit a few years? But then by the time right. you're competing, he's around 30. So it's just kind of a weird spot for him right now.
Yeah, people. It's funny that 30 is old.
Right.
God, do I feel old.
relative to the baseball world.
There's a Seinfeld joke in there somewhere.
But people think that, you know, he's been around forever because the poor kid played in the World Series before he had 55 at-bats in the major leagues. You know, he was a starting right fielder for the Tigers in a World Series game before he'd played a month and a half in the majors. So really, he's kind of young. He's, you know, in the same age group as some of these kids who are considered prime rebuild candidates. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think people want to see what he can do, you know, following this up, because everyone knew he had the talent. There was no question about that. He's a five-tool type of talent. Now, I'm not saying he's got to go out next year and hit 330 and drive in another 80 or 82 runs, but just, you know, will the consistency carry on for him from year to year?
Merck, I need your favorite Carl Everett story. What do you got for me?
Hey, where did that come from?
Yeah, where's Carl Everett come from?
You weren't there for the dinosaur stuff. That was when he was in Boston. But I know Carl Everett was worth a story a day. He had to have been.
Wow, that's, you know, I'd have to think on that one for a little bit.
Sam, that's a random drop. What's your favorite Carl Everett story out of nowhere?
I was going to ask Tony Phillips, there for Tony Phillips.
How is it relevant at all?
I had to think of some obscure player that you covered.
There was no transition there. We went from a rebuild, and is Avi Garcia going to be part of it? So what's your favorite Carl Everett story there?
he's thinking of it right now, though. The wheels are spinning.
We'll get it from Merck eventually. All I know is that this has been a very successful year for the White Sox in terms of what they've been trying to do, the rebuild, and I'm really looking forward to covering a Cubs-White Sox World Series in 2020.
it would be something. And I think, you know, it's funny because the young guys have even given more energy to a team that was already high energy. And with that, you know, they're 14-14 in September. And I think Sox fans are saying, oh, that's great. But in the same sense, they're saying, man, 10-18 wouldn't have been bad either. We could have had like the number two pick or the number one pick, you know. But I think people have to be pleased in what's going on, and it's just the beginning. And that's something that Rick and Kenny and Rick Renteria and everyone who has been interviewed about it will stress, that this is the early stages of it. You know, I mean, I realize the American League was, you know, not overwhelming this year. Well, I think what, five teams are going to finish above 500, and they're all going to be in the playoffs. So you can think a little bit like, maybe can the Sox sneak up and get in the wild card next year? But that's not their end game. Their end game is multiple World Series championships. And, you know, like you guys were saying, it might be, wouldn't it be great if it's amazing there hasn't been a Cubs Sox World Series in all these years. What is it?
Going to happen.
It could.
06 was when they
played. The Cubs are in good position too, young players. So we'll see what plays out.
Let's bring this full circle, Merck. Is Carlos Rodon a member of the White Sox in 2020?
I believe he is. Yes.
That was pretty quick.
That was easier than the Carl Everett story.
Well, yeah, I keep hearing things about the shoulder, and I know you and I have these conversations, and you know, the work ethic for me, in my opinion, it's the work ethic for him. He needs to show me more. And I was at spring training and watching him go through some of these drills, and you know, I don't think he pushed himself all that well in this offseason, and I think that's why it took until June. And I have my doubts about Carlos Rodon going forward. Maybe I'm on my own here. Maybe I'm on an island. But I know there's a lot going on with Scott Boras and things that won't be said and reported. But I have my question marks about durability with Rodon, and I think that's fair.
Well, I think he's an immensely talented kid. And I think, you know, he's even talked about, I know he talked about it in a podcast that he did with Chuck Garfine, and he talked to us in the interview, you know, maybe not going into specifics about that. He's learned some things this year about what he needs to do. And I think every pitcher goes through that. You know, even Mark Burley, who is his, you know, gold standard as it gets, I think, you know, as his career went on, and then now Carlos is more early on in his career, obviously, but, you know, he had to do certain arm exercises and certain arm things in the offseason, and it's something Carlos will learn. You know, I mean, he's another one who's been around for a few years now, but is an extremely young kid, so there's still plenty of upside and potential for him in that rotation.
That's Scott Merkin, MLB.com, White Sox beat writer. I know you're headed down to Instructionals in October, and then you can come home and root on Michigan as they chase a Big Ten title, maybe a national championship down the road. We'll see you soon, Merk. We'll get together after you get back.
Okay, sounds good. Talk to you guys soon.
Thanks,
Scott Merkin, MLB.com. Don't know what that is. My computer decided to just play.
Is that like your DJ playlist?
I don't know what that is.
What do we got going on here?
That's an ad for a Carl Everett story I was looking up about dinosaurs.
Okay, let's address your Carl Everett. I don't know. Where did Carl Everett come from?
Carl Everett was insane.
I know. He believes dinosaurs were made up by the CEA to stop kids from fantasizing about time travel. That's what Carl Everett said.
So I thought Merck would have something on Carl Everett. Maybe he didn't want to throw Everett under the bus because Everett would track him down. Anyways, that's beside the point.
Everett would track him down.
We'll talk hockey in the next hour. We also need to figure out who some of these guys are. I know people don't care about the Bulls because
zero interest.
Incompetence leads to irrelevance. Some of these guys, I have, and I'm a basketball guy. I don't know who any of these guys
are. You're a resident basketball guy, so I'm going to grill you a little bit. I have, like, no clue who half the roster is.
There were two guys at Media Day without names on their uniforms.
Some of them look lost. Like, they walked in, like, am I supposed to be here? What's happening?
It's The Beat, 720 WGN. Got some more nominations for the worst Bears quarterback you've ever seen. Rusty Lish is on there.
Good old Rusty Lish.
Gary Huff.
Good old Gary Huff.
Moses Moreno.
Wow.
To add into the conversation earlier, I didn't know who Will Fuhrer was. We were asking about the worst Bears quarterback you've ever seen. Mike Glennon is one of three I've ever seen.
I'll say this about Glennon. Probably the least athletically gifted of them all. He is in slow motion all the time.
He's so bad.
His reads are slow. His delivery is slow. His feet are – everything is slow with Mike Glennon.
And he's ugly. Not that that matters.
I don't make it personal with these guys.
312-981-7200. We also have a text here and great stuff from Scott Merkin, as always. The Sox would still be duct taping the team if the Cubs had not won the World Series. That makes me sick. Should have been done a long time ago.
That's not accurate.
I think they're onto something there. The Cubs winning certainly accelerated the rebuild.
You mean the White Sox were a little more eager and a little more willing to dive into them?
Because it worked for the Cubs.
Yeah, I think it helped.
Yeah, it helped. Certainly helped.
It probably helped a little bit. I think they would have done it regardless.
I like that text. After we check news, we have to step away for a second. We'll come back. David Jennings is in the newsroom right now. He has your news at 6 o'clock. There are two things we have to talk about after the news. The first, who are these guys at Bulls Media Day? There were two people walking around without names and numbers on their jerseys. This team is going to be so bad, they may win 10 games next year.
Dumb.
And I know nobody cares, but it's fascinating that a team 2 years ago was ready to go and play in the playoffs. They have nobody. And then we'll also talk about the best games that you played in gym class when you were in grade school.
Oh, I got some good ones.
News in 2 minutes, 720 WGN.
Now back to the beat.
720 WGN.
This actually is not a rejoin. This is just coming right from my computer.
Party jams only from DJ Dan Long.
It's the Beat, 609 in Chicago in the Allstate Showcase Studio on 720 WGN. Sam Panionovic and Kevin Powell. Thanks to David Jennings for the newscast. And I want to keep you here, DJ, because I've had three conversations in the last, 48 hours or so. I brought this up 2 days ago about a game that I used to play when I was in grade school in gym class. Everybody had gym class. And if you're listening, send in your favorite games. You can call in 312-981-7200. This game, maybe it's just obscure because it's a Southside game nobody's ever heard of. We called it Steal the Pins. I guess the technical name for it is Capture the Pin. Have you ever heard of Capture the Pin or Steal the Pins, either of you?
I feel like I have. How do you play it?
David, you first. Have you heard of it?
You describe what it is, then I'll tell you if it sounds familiar at all.
Okay. You're in a basketball gym on the court. The center line is the dividing line. You divide everybody into equal teams. 8 players a side, 10 players a side, 12 players a side, whatever. Think of it with 4 bowling pins under each basket. So 4 pins on the left, 4 pins on the right. The objective of the game is to have all the pins, all 8 pins. That's how you win the game. When you're on your side of center court, that is your zone. You're safe in your zone. Once you cross center court, you can be tagged out by the other team. If you're tagged out, you go to what they call jail. So once you cross center court, you can be tagged. You can be put away. The objective, as I said, is to cross the line into enemy territory and steal all the pins. So it's a game of strategy.
Cubs win, by the way, 9-0. It's over.
You were worried. Yeah, it was 9-0 with 2 guys on, and you were sweating. I take it you haven't heard of Steal the Pins or Capture the Pins.
No.
Okay.
That was not a game we played in Brooklyn.
What did you play in Brooklyn? What was the big game in grade school and gym class? Could even be high school, too. Because I think everything is, it's not uniformity. There's not like you have to do this when you're in grade school. It's all on the gym teacher.
Let's see. Elementary school, I think it was more like tag or dodgeball.
Let me introduce you guys to maybe the greatest gym game of all time. It's called Chook Ball. We had a listener text in from the 6th grade. Chook Ball was the greatest sport I ever played in school. It's huge in Sweden.
I've never heard of Chook
Ball. All right,
Chook Ball.
You
played Chook Ball?
Played Chook Ball all the time at Hersey High School. All right, Chook Ball. Like, think of the mini trampolines, almost like those exercise ones that were around when we were younger. You know what I'm talking about? Maybe 3 feet by diameter, whatever. Just those small ones. Then envision that on a 90-degree angle. So you're basically on a basketball court, right? And one end, like you said, by one basket, there's the trampoline on the angle, and then vice versa on the other side as well. So there's you have a ball, and you have two teams, obviously, and you don't dribble the ball. You have to pass it. Like, you can't run with it, so you have to, like, pass with people. And the objective is to throw the ball off the trampoline, and then there's sort of like a three-point arc, you know, around the trampoline. You've got to throw the ball, hit the trampoline. It has to bounce off the trampoline and land on the ground outside of the arc.
So you have to throw it with enough force and enough of an angle to get it to ricochet
right.
Off the trampoline outside of this little zone.
Yes. And if the
Who dreamt up these games?
So if the ball hits the trampoline, if you're on the defense, if you catch the ball off the trampoline, it's no point. So it's awesome. Like, people are playing the angles on the trampoline.
Is that phys ed or geometry class?
It's both. It's life lessons 101.
So people, like, are diving for the ball. You're playing all sorts of angles, and there's different points for, you know, wherever the ball lands. It's awesome sport. Ton of fun.
We also played. Now, dodgeball is the common game when you're in grade school. Everybody plays dodgeball, and you know the rules of dodgeball. You've seen the movie Dodgeball with Vince Vaughn.
Don't get hit.
Right. What are the five D's of dodgeball? Duck, dodge, dip, dive, and dodge.
Something like that. 847 says your game called that's Steal the Bacon from the Northwest.
No,
Suburbs.
Steal the Bacon's different. Steal the Bacon is when the bacon's in the middle of the arena or the middle of the floor. The pins are on opposite ends. I'm almost positive those are different. Our gym teacher in grade school at Washington Elementary on the southeast side, we played scooter dodgeball. You're on this little wooden board with four wheels, and you cannot, your hands cannot touch the floor, your feet can, and you're driving around the gym on a little wooden board with wheels. And then you have to throw at the other player while you're balancing on this wooden board.
And your feet can't touch the floor.
No, they can, because that's how you move. You're like Fred Flintstone in the car. That's how you move around the gym.
I know what you're talking about. Let's go to Chris from the 630. He's on line one. He's got more on Chukball.
Yeah, Chukball was the game of my life. That was the greatest game.
Amazing.
You missed two very important facts about it, though.
Okay, what do you got?
First thing was you cannot, like, intercept the ball between players. Like, there's just the passing, and, like, if it bounces off, you have to try to catch it, and that's it. Like, you can't, like, get in between the ball when it's going between people. That's not as important as the second thing. Second thing is there's no defending or offensive or defense side. Like, you can run with the ball all the way to the one side and then just stop, lob it directly behind you, and have it bounce off the other trampoline on the other side. Super complex game.
I've never heard of it, Chris. Did you play this all the time when you were a kid?
No, not when I was a kid. In high school, we played it like every chance we got, pretty much.
I love it. It's fun. It's a good exercise, too. You're sprinting all over the place.
Thanks for checking
it's
in.
A lot of running. Yep.
Chris 773 says pickleball. That was always fun.
We played wiffle ball a lot.
You ever play pickleball?
I've never played pickleball. Is that what the...
It's essentially tennis with just like a little paddle and a different sort of ball on a smaller net, on a smaller scale.
Wiffle ball was big. I remember I liked everything in gym until it was time to run the mile, and then I'd always be sick that day.
Yeah.
I didn't like to run.
Yeah, not a huge fan.
Today we're just going to run a mile. I'm like, I'm going to pass. I don't feel good.
We just have to do the... What was it? The 13-minute mile, and it was just you had to run for 13 minutes, and you had to get as many laps in as possible in the field house.
Ugh.
And then you had to hit certain benchmarks, and that would determine basically your phys ed plan for the rest of the semester. So if you didn't get a lot of laps, they were like, okay, you're fat and out of shape, kid. That was normally my circumstance. And they would, I would have to do cardio stuff more often during the week, where the other kids who were, you know, in shape, they got to play all the cool games all the time.
This may be generational, but we didn't have that when I was in elementary, junior, or high school.
You didn't have what?
None of that stuff.
What did you guys do
a
in
workout?
Gym class?
Cardio plan?
Well, you guys went and smoked cigarettes during gym class.
No one used the word cardio. I mean, I graduated from high school in 72.
Great year.
So we didn't have gym class. Gym class in high school, I'm not going to get into because you know why I'm not going to get into that.
I can only imagine.
Well, there was a story about something similar to how our high school dealt with gym, because if you couldn't swim, you didn't go to gym class. You went to swimming class instead.
Well, that was in my father and his generation. They used to swim. The gym teacher would make them swim naked.
Well, Chicago wasn't the only place where that happened.
I believe it. Danny Long, favorite game in gym class growing up, what was it?
See, I'm a traditionalist. I liked the, you know, spring, getting outside, playing a little softball.
That's always fun. Kickball was always obviously amazing. Legendary.
I never liked kickball. I could hit really well. I couldn't kick. I couldn't kick the ball.
We didn't have softball in junior high school. There was a little handball, but that was about it.
Kickball was fun. We would play in our field house, so you could hit it off the certain parts of the wall, and it was a home run. So that added a little different element than playing outside. It was actually a lot more fun in the field house.
In junior high, our gym teacher had this idea to try archery. and give a bunch of arrows and bows to a bunch of 12-year-olds.
And then the arrow was in the side of your gym teacher's neck, and scrapped that plan.
It was a one-time deal, believe it or not.
Yeah. Did it even last for a whole day?
No.
I didn't think so.
It didn't. Okay. Somebody had a pierced bicep, and fun was over. And then the whole class is in detention because so-and-so had to shoot somebody else with a bow and arrow when we were 12 years old.
Yeah,
why did the whole class go to detention? It was the teacher's brilliant idea.
Because the teacher has to pass on blame to somebody else. That's how it works. That's how things go. We also had this game in high school called All Ball. And mind you, Kevin, this is at an all-boys high school, Mount Carmel. Testosterone-driven people, lots of them football players. Kind of like a hockey setup. The wrestling mats were laid onto the court. The dividers on the side, like the stairs, the stands, like the wooden stands, that was the boundary. Anything goes. You have to throw this little dodgeball into the net, but you could tackle.
Yeah,
you could push.
We had the same thing in our we have a wrestling room at our high school, and it's just all padded. It's wrestling mats, and the walls are a little bit padded. And on one end, we had these little nets, and we would all be on our knees, and you had to like shimmy on your knees. It wasn't running because the wrestling room's pretty small. And it was, thrown in the net, but it was people just taking each other out. And we were like,
did you guys have to do the rope climb?
We did the rope climb. I could never climb the rope.
It's tough.
I could never do it.
I was good for about the 40-yard dash. That was it.
And there was always that little kid who was like 3 foot tall that would get on the rope and he'd climb all the way to the ceiling
and
touch the ceiling.
And embarrass everyone.
And you got guys that are, big, strong kids for their age, 10, 11, 12 years old. They actually work out and it would all be the littlest person in the room would climb the rope and show off in front of everybody.
That's one of those kids whose parents should have been told, is your son athletic? Well, yeah, good. Tell him don't overdo it in gym class. It's only going to make his life much more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I have a story. I don't know if I should tell it.
I think you should tell it.
Oh, what the heck. Change the names to protect the guilty.
Coming up after the break, I'll tell the story. You're listening to The Beat on 720 WGN. All right, after further review, I've decided the risk outweighs the reward by telling the story that I had teased before the break, so I apologize for not paying off the tease.
I would love to put you in a tough situation. As much as I would not tell that story either.
I'm not going to tell it. Like I said, the risk outweighs the reward. It's a good story, though.
A couple quick notes here. This courtesy of Kevin Fishbane from The Athletic, by the way. We talked about the Bears early on in the show.
Danny Trevathan suspended 2 games, if you missed it, for his hit on Devontae Adams in Thursday night's loss in Green Bay.
Bears now 1-3. They're awful on the road. They got smoked in Tampa, crushed in Green Bay. How about this from Kevin Fishbane? The Cubs have clinched the NL Central twice since the Bears last won a game on the road.
Wow.
And also, moreover, here's the starting lineup for the Chicago Bulls the last time the Bears won a road game.
Okay.
Derrick Rose.
Okay.
Jimmy Butler. Pau Gasol. Taj Gibson. Nico Mirotic. That was the Bulls starting lineup the last time the Bears won a road game in October of 2015. It's incredible.
Hey, can you remember, I guess both of us are pretty young here, and there's been a lot. We haven't seen a ton of Bears football compared to some people probably listening, or but this is the lowest I can remember the Bears being in terms of, they're just horrible. I mean, it's a bad place, and I guess the only reason that it maybe isn't the lowest of lows is because they have a quarterback that we all believe could potentially be a franchise quarterback. Mitch Trubisky's keeping the Bears relevant. Imagine if Mitch Trubisky wasn't on the team. Imagine if Ryan Pace didn't go for Mitch Trubisky. Remember all the criticism he got for moving up? I've defended that pick because I don't care how much you give up to get what you believe to be a franchise quarterback. If he does turn out to be a guy who's here for 10 years, does lead him to the playoffs, win a Super Bowl, Ryan Pace could have traded every single one of his picks to move up one spot to get Mitch Trubisky. That's how much the quarterback position matters. So I loved a guy going out, putting his neck on the line and say, I'm getting this guy because I believe he's the one. I'm not taking any risk here. I don't care if the 49ers were or weren't going to even be interested in taking him. You don't risk that. If you're Ryan Pace and you believe Mitch Trubisky can be a franchise quarterback, you absolutely move up in the draft. I don't care if you gave up more than what you should have in hindsight. It doesn't matter. At that moment, Ryan Pace identified his guy. He believes in Mitch Trubisky. You go get him. Imagine if Mitch Trubisky wasn't on this roster. Imagine if Ryan Pace took a defensive back, a safety in that spot, or a defensive lineman. And we're sitting here right now with Mike Glennon and Mark Sanchez as the two quarterbacks of the Bears. Imagine how low of a place the Bears would be right now, even more so than what they already are. Mitch Trubisky is everything right now. He's the future of this franchise. He's hope.
Okay, what's wrong with the Bears then?
A lack of talent, mostly. Some would say there's a lot of maybe coaching issues with John Fox.
It was gutted by the last regime. Phil Emery and Mark Trestman completely drove it into the ground, and Ryan Pace is still trying to build it back up. They're still, David, a rebuilding football team. But their hope is this year that they can allocate enough people on this roster. They can look at the offense, look at the defense, and say, well, we have seven guys that we like that we can carry forward. We have six guys on this side we can carry forward.
Well, on the defensive side of the ball, I think there's a lot of positives there. Defense hasn't been bad at all this year. It's the offensive side of things, and it'll start if Mitch Trubisky can turn into a legitimate starting quarterback. They have next to nothing at the receiver position. That'll change this offseason, I'm sure. We're already talking about this upcoming offseason.
Yeah, week well, five, that's, but, what it's, that's what's come down that, to.
That's obviously something they have to address. So to answer your question, David, it's a lack of talent right now. They just don't have a ton of it.
Certainly. Here is the Bulls training camp roster real quick. These guys, I don't know who half of them are.
Keep in mind, Sam's sort of our resident sports guy.
I am the college
basketball guy. Resident basketball guy.
And there were two guys at Bulls Media Day for the last couple of years. It's Derrick Rose, Jimmy Butler, Pau Gasol, Joakim Noah, Taj Gibson. Personalities, guys you know. There were two guys walking around the damn Advocate Center without a number and without a name on their jersey. How does this happen? How are you so irrelevant that you don't have names and numbers on your people's jersey?
Because when you go to
if the summer lineup, if all of those guys walked into the studio right this second, how many of them could you identify by and put a name on?
The Bulls put a tweet out on Media Day with pictures of six players. David, I knew two of them.
All right, give me some names.
Diamond Stone.
Never heard of him.
Antonio Blakeney.
Never heard of him.
David Nwaba.
That's a fake name.
Ryan Archidiakono, who I know because he played at Villanova. Quincy Pondexter.
Okay, I know that name.
Jalen Johnson.
Nope.
Jarrell Eddy.
Who are these f***ing guys?
I don't know. I don't know who they are. I have no idea who these people are. This team is so sad and so pathetic.
How many names from last season are coming back?
Bobby Portis, Jaron Grant, Cristiano Felicio, Paul Zipser, Cameron Payne, Robin Lopez, Denzel Valentine. So seven guys are back. How many can play? Two.
All right, let's look ahead. Who is the, let's see here. Who is next year's?
Let's look at the lottery. Who's the number one pick next year?
Because sometimes, like, people know like 2 or 3 years in advance with some of these players.
The Bulls' win total in Vegas right now, it's the lowest in the league. It's 21. 21 wins. That means they're going to lose 60 games or more. They could lose 65. They might lose 70. They're so bad. So and I'm just all riled up.
You're riled up. What's the attendance going to be like at United Center?
They'll probably still sell out because the fans are just go. They go.
The Bulls.
It's always sold out.
It's a Jordan effect.
Even when the Cubs were awful, they still sold out.
The Bulls are an international brand, and they can thank Michael Jordan for that. It's The Beat, 720 WGN. .637 on The Beat, 720 WGN Radio, taking you up to the top of the hour. Blackhawks hockey, the pregame show, 7 o'clock, puck drop 7:30. John and Troy will join the party then. Blackhawks and the Bruins, and guess what, Kev? Regular season next week.
Thursday night, we'll be out there at the United Center leading up to it. Ro and Anna and the gang, you can swing by there. But, man, it sneaks up on you. I'm pumped for Blackhawks hockey.
Hawks and Penguins.
That's right. The reigning Stanley Cup champion Pittsburgh Penguins.
And that scoreboard is evened up right now. Hawks have 3 cups in this core. Penguins have 3 cups in this core. Penguins have won back-to-back cups, which is unprecedented in the salary cap era. It's going to be a good game.
It'll be fun.
First of many. We have audio from Comcast Sportsnet Chicago. This is Pat Foley after he threw out the first pitch at Wrigley Field.
I've never felt so much pressure on a baseball field ever. Eddie Olczyk was a good ball player when he was a kid.
Yes, he was.
And if I bounce that thing in there, he may never speak to me again.
But yes, conductor for Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Blackhawks TV broadcaster Pat Foley.
All right! Let Eddie O hear you all the way in the suburbs. Good and loud. A one, a two.
Pat gets a perfect 10 score for giving a shout-out to Eddie O. We're all obviously thinking of Eddie and wishing him nothing but the best.
Yeah, for Eddie. I talked about this last week. I was sitting in this chair a week ago. I texted Eddie the day after I found out. I've been able to know Eddie for, let's see, Blackhawks Radio. I started there in 2013 after the lockout. So I've known Eddie 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 5 years now. One of the nicest guys in the world. So genuine. I didn't really know much about hockey because I didn't play hockey growing up, and I couldn't watch hockey growing up because the games weren't on television. Mm-hmm. So I always fancied myself as a basketball, baseball, and football guy. Go figure, I get an internship here at WGN, and my first job after producing Cubs games that offseason was, and Dan Long and I used to do it together, the Blackhawks radio games. In fact, Danny and I produced Game 6. Was it Game 6? 2013? Hawks and Bruins.
17 seconds.
Huge.
We were producing that night. We were getting ready.
You're scrambling, pulling those highlights?
We were getting ready to produce losing Blackhawks postgame. I'll never forget this as long as I live. And they tied it. And then Dan's like, we got to cut the goal. We got to cut the goal. They need to go to a break. We're going to overtime. We're going to overtime. And then they score again. And in literally, it was 17 seconds of game time, but what, about 3 minutes of real time? We went from producing losing Blackhawks postgame to Stanley Cup championship winning postgame.
It was wild.
But the moral of the story is Eddie Olczyk has been the most genuine, kind person, and he's taught me a lot about the game, and it's a battle that nobody ever wants to see, you know, and I know the support staff for Olczyk is high. We wish him and his wife, Diana, the best and the kids. And he says he's coming back and he texted me, I'm going to fight it and I'm going to win.
We all expect nothing less from Eddie. I echo everything you've said and just a great guy. And I think, you know, you said he learned a bunch about hockey from Eddie. I think everyone has just from listening to his broadcast, you know. And does anybody do it better than Eddie?
Stop it right there.
I love in the at the games they have, you know, during play when people are walking in from the concourse and they don't want people walking into the stands blocking views, they have the ushers hold a little sign that says, stop it right there.
In the aisles, yeah. When the puck's in play, you can't go to your seat if you've been
right
in the concourse. Yeah, it's a big, it's an Olczyk head, right? It's
yeah, like a, something like that, or stop sign says something, but it's, we're pulling for Eddie.
He's one of the best, and I don't just say that just to say that. He's a really special cat, and we hope him, we hope that everything goes the way it should. We hope everything goes well, and we hope that he's back. He says 6 months. We shall see. I know he won't rush it. But he wants to be in the booth. That's where he belongs. And him and Pat are just so awesome together. I mean, amazing. You think about the chemistry in the booth that those two have. John and Troy are great as well. Pat and Eddie are awesome.
And that's, Eddie with Doc as well on the National.
I mean, we have the best pair of broadcasters in the TV booth and the radio booth. If you're in the car and you listen, you're in for a treat. If you're at home, same way. So all of us here at WGN are wishing Eddie Olczyk the best in his recovery. And we'll see you soon at the rink, Edzo. I know he's still picking the ponies, though, too. He's not going to stop doing that. It's time to start working on that fall bucket list. Time to plan your trip up to Richmond, Illinois. Navigate Richards' corn maze or pick apples at one of the area orchards. It's all on your way to Anderson's Candy Shop on Route 12 in Richmond. You can practically smell the fresh caramel apples and the mini donuts from here. They have new maple truffles topped with candied bacon, pumpkin spice truffles, candy bars that taste like s'mores, and the best caramel apples you will ever eat. The folks at Anderson's use fresh-picked apples every week, and with varieties like Zestar, Empire, and Liberty apples, you'll be driving back again for more. If the lure of the fresh caramel apples isn't enough, how about the taste of warm, fluffy mini donuts dusted with cinnamon and sugar? Every Saturday through Halloween, Anderson's Richmond location will serve their famous cinnamon and sugar mini donuts fresh to order. You can do that from 10 to 4. You can always order online, andersonscandyshop.com, andersonscandyshop.com, for everything you must try this fall. Scott King coming up next on The Beat.
Down the stretch here on The Beat, 720 WGN, Kevin Powell, he's Sam Panayotovich. It's been fun the past few hours here, Sammy.
Always is.
Having a good time. If you missed it, the MLB postseason is completely set. We're ready for October baseball. I can't wait. It'll be Cubs-Nationals. That starts Friday. The Dodgers await the winner of the wild card game between the Rockies and Diamondbacks in the American League. The wild card game is the Twins and Yankees at Yankee Stadium. The winner of that will play the reigning AL champion Cleveland Indians, and then Boston and Houston face off on the other side of the bracket. Sam, a couple weeks ago, I threw a prediction out there, and I'm sticking with it. Cubs-Indians repeat again in the World Series.
Really?
Yeah.
I think the Diamondbacks are my sleeper.
Yeah, they're good, man. NL West, look out.
I have them 75-1. Maybe that's why I'm saying that.
Okay.
That's probably why I'm saying Diamondbacks.
We're excited for postseason baseball. We're also very excited for Blackhawks hockey. Preseason finale tonight, and then the regular season starts right around the corner. Thursday against the Pittsburgh Penguins. We can't wait for that. But one more preseason game. Scott King, our Blackhawks insider here at WGN, is on the line with us. Scott, how you doing?
Gentlemen, how's it going? I'm sitting in a stairwell in the Knight Center so I can talk to my two friends.
I've been there before, man. I've been in that stairwell so many times. So our roster pretty much set, right? I mean, maybe a couple more cuts down the road, but I mean, you pretty much know who's going to be on this roster, right?
I think so, Sam. Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a couple good surprises. I think they were hoping Anton Forsberg would be a good backup, and he's playing again tonight. He's looked great. You know, a guy who didn't have, you know, he had 10 NHL games under his belt, but he's looked really good in camp. I think the guys they brought over, like Tommy Wingles, you know, they're going to be there in the bottom six. I think the Alex DeBrincat was another surprise. I think that they thought maybe later on in the season you would see him anywhere in the lineup, especially top six playing with Kane, but he's got chances right away with Kane, and he's looked great playing again tonight. So I think you see him jump right in opening night. I think he'll be in the lineup.
Yeah, who is playing tonight? Are the starters playing, or are they pretty much resting some of the regulars? What's it going to look like tonight on the ice?
Yeah, tonight it looks like almost a mirror image of the opening night lineup, what you would imagine, except Forsberg's in net. And it looks like from the morning skate, it looks like Lance Bomba was in instead of Tommy Wingles on the fourth line. So that's interesting. It's kind of like another opportunity for Lance Bomba, who's coming over from Calgary, who, I don't know, he really hasn't had a great camp. And like I said, Tommy Wingles is a guy who's probably definitely going to be in. So this could be Quinville maybe giving him another shot to do something where maybe he could stick around as the extra forward.
Here are your lines: Saad, Taves, Panic. Got Sharp, Schmaltz, Kane, DeBrincat, Anisimov, and Hartman. Those are your top nine forwards. And your D pairings, this is where I'm interested, Scott, to see how this develops over the season, the first couple of weeks of the season. Duncan Keith and Connor Murphy. How do you expect that will play out?
Yeah, that's something I actually wrote about in my preview of the season in Chicago Magazine. And I really like that. And I talked to both Connor Murphy and Duncan Keith about working together, and they really like the fit. Duncan Keith prefers to play with big D men that are physical. Murphy's, you know, not only is he big and physical, but he can use that reach as a bigger player, and he can cover more ice when Duncan jumps in on the rush and contributes to the offense the way he likes to. So I think that's honestly, that could be a match made in heaven. I think Murphy wasn't on a great Coyotes team, so, you know, maybe that's why his numbers aren't stellar. But I think he could do really well here, and especially playing with Duncan Keith.
All right, looking forward to the regular season and the entire campaign here. What are some of the strengths and what are some of the weaknesses that you're keeping an eye on with this team?
Yeah, another surprise I think is going to end up being a big strength all season long is the shape Patrick Sharp showed up in and the way he's looked in camp. I think Sam and Kevin, you know, obviously you should have some success if you put him on a second line with Kane, but I like to keep the Brinkett there. And I think you put Sharp in that third line, and it looks like Sharp, like tonight, Sharp, Anisimov, Hartman, you have a line that has energy. You have a kind of a checking line. It could be a shutdown line, and you could have some scoring. So with Panic, Saad, and Taves on that first line, you have that third. You have the best first and third lines in the league. And, of course, Kane can score whoever he's with. You just hope that if the Brinkett gets a chance and he sticks in the lineup, that you hope that he's sound defensively. Because you know with Quinville, if you're not or if a player's not, you're going to be out of the lineup pretty fast. So you just hope that he has that defensive responsibility in his game. I think he knows what's expected of him, and he will. But I also like John Hayden on the fourth line, a guy who crashes the nets. Not only can you probably have a good shutdown fourth line like the Hawks have had in the past, but you can have some scoring with Hayden the way he crashes the net there. A guy from Yale who played a handful of games last year, scored pretty early in one of his first couple games with the Hawks. So I think forwards are real strong looking, and I think there could be a couple nice surprises on defense, and maybe Forsberg will surprise you as a good backup too.
I like giving these younger guys on defense a shot, too. I mean, it just got tiring. I got tired watching Johnny Oduya and Brian Campbell get tired, Scott. It was tiring to watch them get tired last year.
Yeah, and you kind of hope that Campbell would have had a nice, you know, going-away season, a nicer one. But the guy had a heck of a career, a great guy. And, no, yeah, you're exactly right. I think you give a guy like Forslane some more responsibility and some more ice time. You hope that he takes the leap that he needs to take, and he develops the way he needs to develop. And I think he will, and I think Kempney is going to play with Seabrook, and he'll be better. Kempney and Forsling were guys who played about half the season last year, each of them, like 40, 50 games or so. And you just need them to get to that next level, and they have to. And there's a guy playing tonight. It's another big game tonight. You know, it's not just a final preseason game. It's a big game for Lance Bowman to do something to get noticed and stick around, but also – Jordan Osterley. Jordan Osterley is a guy who Quinville, I think it was Sam Eggy were there. It was maybe the first preseason game. Quinville said, I liked him. And he paused and he goes, I liked him a lot. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to get him to say that about Patrick Kane. So the way that he likes Jordan Osterley coming over from the Oilers system, a guy who hasn't played a whole lot and can really have a chance to do something here. That's a guy who's flown under the radar, but you know Joel Quinville likes him. He's in there again tonight. So interesting, there's still, you know, maybe two guys on the bubble. You know, the roster is pretty much set for opening night, I think, but there's still two guys who have chances.
I'm talking with Scott King, our Blackhawks insider here at WGN Radio. Scott, darling, a fan favorite, shipped out of town, traded away. Anton Forsberg now the backup to Corey Crawford. You said Forsberg's going to play tonight. What have you seen from him this preseason, and is he up to the task of backing up Corey Crawford?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough task. You go back all the way back to 2012-2013 season when you had Ray Emery. Since then, Corey Crawford has had amazing backups. You have Antti Raanta. You have Scott Darling. So Crawford's used to having 20, 25 games off, and he's used to being fresh for the playoffs. Can Anton Forsberg give him that? I don't know. That's the only thing I don't know about Forsberg's duration, how many games he can play consecutively if Crawford needs a rest or if he gets hurt. But I do know he's looked really good in camp. I know he's made the athletic, almost Corey Crawford-type saves when you're sprawling, when you're going post-to-post. So I think he's an athletic goalie. I think he's very positionally sound. We'll just see how much he can play, how many games he can log, how much ice time he could have in order to save Crawford some rest.
Jonathan Toews is never going to score 40 goals. He's never going to score 100 points. We know that's the case. But he does so many things away from the puck, and he's so good defensively. He's a shutdown guy. He's on the power play. He's on the penalty kill. I do think, though, I can see an offensive resurgence because putting him with Brandon Saad, that was when Taves was at his best, when that combo was clicking before they traded Saad away. I'm excited to watch Jonathan Taves have a power forward like Brandon Saad who will go to the net and do things in the dirty areas.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sam. I think it's a big reason Stan Bowman traded Panarin to get Saad back is you had to get Taves going again, and he did play his best with Saad, like you said. And like I mentioned earlier, there's surprises in camp. There's surprises leading up to the season. I think everyone expects Jonathan Taves to play better with Brandon Saad. I definitely do. Those guys know where the other guy's going to be. They're just great anticipation and play development with both of them. They both can be guys who crash the net Taves not so much last year, but he might be looking to do that this year. And both guys with great shots. So you do look for them to contribute a lot of offense. Again, Richard Panik, a guy who could really play some hard-nosed hockey, can be an agitator. That line is just going to be a force to be reckoned with. They can do a lot to get each other the puck. But like I said, what if a surprise as the season gets going here, what if Taves doesn't, you know, contribute the way you want him to offensively? What if there's trouble finding that chemistry with Saad? Again, I don't think that something's going to happen, but there's always these surprises that first in training camp and then after the season gets going. So I guess my question is, what's going to be the surprise after the season gets going?
He's on Twitter at Scott King Media. We'll read you on WGNRadio.com. We'll listen to the Blackhawks Crazy podcast. Have a good one tonight, Scotty. I'll see you on Thursday at the opener.
Thank you, fellas. Take it easy.
Scott King, WGN Radio. Pretty nice show, Adam Hoge. Thanks to him. Thanks to Ned Colletti. The stories about Frank Sinatra and Ron Santo and Tommy Lasorda.
I could have talked to Ned Colletti for an hour, too. I could have talked to him the whole show. He's got story after story. Longtime exec. Check out his book, the title of it.
The Big Chair.
Check it out with blanking for a second. The Big Chair. That was a great stuff. So all this will be on WGNRadio.com on the podcast format.
Thanks to Scott Merkin and Scott King. Blackhawks hockey coming up next.